B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Thursday, April 26, 2018. Today, a jury outside Philadelphia, after deliberating for a pretty brief period of time, returned three guilty verdicts, and America's dad, Bill Cosby, stands convicted before the entire nation of rape. Now, this is not a surprising verdict. We've known about Bill Cosby through the revelations in depositions, through the tens of women who've gone public. The number is up there around 60 overall. That over many years, he had a practice of engaging in contact with women, slipping them drugs, and then when they were unconscious and unable to resist his advances, he would have sex with them. And of course, for many people, this is such a betrayal. Because through the entire 1980s and into the 90s, Bill Cosby's TV show showed him as this amazing guy with the $1,000 sweaters, presiding over the happiest black household in these United States. And he became quite a preacher. He was a self-righteous prick. And he'd go out there and vilify younger black people. And he didn't limit himself to policing African Americans. He became a figure after they gave him an honorary doctorate. He insisted that people call him Dr. Cosby. So he's really a dark and twisted figure. And I fully believe the women who came forward, some at considerable personal risk, and many of whom faced an array of denials and character assassination from Cosby and his high-paid lawyers and his allies. And so I believe the jury got it right. That said, I have to tell you that I am uncomfortable with the way this retrial was conducted and the fact that the judge allowed women who had reasonable, credible claims that Cosby had used drugs in order to force them into a sexual, I'm straining for polite language here, but he raped them. And the problem I have is that the women who testified, except for Andrea Constand, were not a party to this case. And their claims, for various reasons, all pretty legitimate, their cases have never been adjudicated. They've never been able to persuade a jury to convict Bill Cosby of their specific crimes. And I believe that this will be a huge issue on appeal. And I'll bet Cosby's lawyers will file very quickly, and it'll tie up his conviction for at least several years. Now, the bizarre moment in the courtroom today was when, after the verdict was read, there was a bit of cheering from the side of the accusers. And then the prosecutor asked the judge to revoke Bill Cosby's $1 million bail, saying, look, he's got an airplane and he could flee. And at that point, Cosby, who of course didn't take the stand and has not uttered a word during these proceedings, he stood up and he said, referring to himself in the third person, he doesn't have a plane, you asshole. Now, that's a pretty remarkable thing for him to do. I'm sure that he, of course, feels that he is a victim here and that his rights have been violated. And as I've said, I have issues with the legal process here and the testimony that the judge permitted at this trial. But it doesn't change my view that he was guilty in the incident with Ms. Constand, despite the fact that she was paid $3+ million back in 2006 to keep quiet. I believe that she did the right thing to bring this case, and in the face of the hung jury a year ago, to submit to a retrial as well. The other sexual predator making news today is the guy in the White House. And Trump, who should have taken note that yesterday we learned publicly that his attorney, Michael Cohen, is going to take the Fifth because he doesn't want to self-incriminate in testimony he might give in a Stormy Daniels case in California. It could compromise the investigation by the district attorney, the U.S. attorney in Manhattan, into Michael Cohen. And Trump should have taken a note from that. He wouldn't even have to pay Michael Cohen for advice. But instead, Trump spent a half hour phoning into his favorite TV show, Fox and Friends, this morning, where he rambled on many topics, and he basically incriminated himself and complicated the lies that he's already told about whether he knew Michael Cohen had paid Stormy Daniels $130,000 through this shell corporation that he set up. But Trump just blurted out that, you know, Michael Cohen, he's trying to minimize his involvement with Cohen. So he said, you know, he did a little bit of legal work for me, a small, tiny fraction, a tiny, tiny little fraction. But Michael would represent me and represent me on some things. Oh, he represents me like with this crazy Stormy Daniels deal. He represented me. Now, this undermines the claims that Michael Cohen has made that he made the hush money payoff without Trump's knowledge. Now, separately, Cohen's assertion there that Trump didn't know about it appears to eliminate the attorney-client privilege because he did it on his own, right? And so Trump has muddied the waters here to the delight of Michael Avenatti, who is the attorney for Stephanie Clifford, who is Stormy Daniels. And so Trump is... let me just share this with you. I was in the dentist chair this morning, and I love my hygienist. Her name is Jerry. She talks politics while she's working in my mouth, you know. And we have very similar views. But she said she had seen the a clip of Trump's phone call to Fox and Friends before she left for work this morning. And she said, he's not shooting himself in his foot. He's shooting himself in his dick. And she's not prone to salty language. So, Jerry, you get the quote of the day. So, Avenatti said the president's statements are very, very damaging to him in our case. It directly contradicts what he said on Air Force One relating to his knowledge or lack thereof of the agreement for $130,000. This is going to add considerable momentum to our efforts to depose the president, place him under oath, because now we have two contrary statements made within the same month relating to what he knew about the agreement, what he didn't know, what his relationship was with Cohen, and we're going to utilize that statement today to argue for his deposition. And we'll get into a little more of the rambling phone call here in a moment, but it's important to note that shortly after Trump, and by the way, Jerry says that the people at Fox and Friends appeared to end the conversation with Trump before he was ready. They said, don't you have work to do? I haven't seen that myself, but that's what I heard. Anyway, shortly after that phone-in appearance, the judge who is overseeing the raid on Michael Cohen's office, home, and hotel room, and that would be Federal District Judge Kimba Wood, has appointed a retired judge, whose name is Barbara Jones, to serve as the special master. And her job will be to review all the stuff that the investigators picked up from Cohen to ensure that it doesn't violate the attorney-client privilege and that the materials are relevant to whatever the scope of the investigation is, and you and I are not privy to that at this point. So that's all moving forward. And Trump has done this before with Felix Sater. He says, you know, if he walked in the room, I wouldn't recognize him. Well, he's now trying to distance himself from Cohen, and I'm sure some of his Twitter followers will believe this, but anybody who has just watched this and observed it with fresh eyes knows what's going on here. So one of the things Trump said in the phone call today, and the The mangled syntax here will get in the way. But he said that he had tried not to interfere in Justice Department matters, which in many past administrations have been protected from political interference. But he warned that at some point, I won't. And I guess what he's saying is that he won't not interfere. And that's a double negative. Take 10 points off for bad grammar and syntax. Anyway, what else did he have to say? Well, he made comments, by the way, that it's Melania's birthday. Oh, that poor woman. You know, she is generating a lot of sympathy just for, you know, wearing those, $100,000 gowns and the pretty hat and standing there and denying him handholding. But, boy, does she pay a price. Anyway, it is her birthday. Asked what he gave her for the occasion. He said, maybe I didn't get her so much. I got her a beautiful card. Signed by Stormy Daniels, maybe. Anyway, he told the fine folks at Fox and Friends that he sent Mike Pompeo to North Korea, but didn't actually expect him to get to meet with Kim Jong-un. They did meet, spent an hour together, and boy, was it great. That's my inference there. He also went on and on in his stream of consciousness, talked about his election victory, and then went after Andy McCabe, falsely asserting that McCabe, whose wife ran for the state senate in Virginia and received $700,000 for her campaign from Terry McAuliffe, who was at the time the governor of Virginia and, of course, a longtime bagman for the Clintons. And the idea that that money made it to the McCabe family account is completely speculative. Nobody has ever asserted that. And by the way, the Senate race was in 2015. And the investigation into Clinton's emails and into the Trump-Russia stuff all occurred in 2016. And so it doesn't even pass the fundamental timeline or smell test, but of course, it works for Trump, and that's all he cares about. So beyond that, he just rambled, and this gave Chuck Schumer the opportunity, the Democratic leader in the Senate, to act like a statesman. The president seems to live in an alternative reality, said Schumer. He says things that are patently false. He thinks just by saying them, they become true. The amount of 180-degree turns, name-calling, and blaming. You watch the president this morning and the way he acted, it is so unbecoming of a president and democracy. Well, I guess Schumer has it right, for once. Today, the United States Senate voted to confirm Mike Pompeo as second Secretary of State of the Trump administration so far. And while it had appeared that it might be close, the Democrats would unite to oppose this. There were six Democrats and the independent Angus King of Maine who voted to confirm Mike Pompeo. And in a moment, I'll name the names here. But this is a travesty. The Democrats could have stopped this. And they go through the motions. They, you know, have these kind of tough questioning sessions on TV. But they were not intent on denying him confirmation. If so, they could have wrangled Rand Paul and gotten him to hold to his original position. And the first three defectors, of course, were Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota, Joe Manchin of West Virginia, and Joe Donnelly of Indiana. And let us add a couple of other names to the list of these infamous so-called Democrats. Doug Jones of Alabama. Not surprised. Roger Shuler predicted that Doug Jones is barely a Democrat. And because, of course, Trump won Alabama, you're never going to see any courage out of Doug Jones. Also, Claire McCaskill of Missouri, who appears to have another golden reelection campaign lined up for her because of the Greitens, the governor, the Republican governor of Missouri with his sex scandal. Nevertheless, she covered her little tush and voted for it, and so did Bill Nelson of Florida. I guess he feels, again, Trump won Florida. He's going to run against Charlie Crist this fall. And, of course, they can say, well, my vote didn't really matter because the Republicans had it dialed in. But we know. And I, at least for one, will not forget. Yesterday, I was criticizing Rachel Maddow for her excessive coverage of the problems with Trump's nominee to run the Veterans Affairs Department, Dr. Ronnie Jackson, who is a Navy admiral. And I pointed out that Jackson was not going to survive. It's very clear from the repeated reports of his binge drinking. They added to that that he wrecked a government car while he was drunk. He earned the nickname the Candyman because he'd hand out opiates and sleeping pills to anybody who asked for them in the White House. Percocet was one case. So it was clear to me that Ronnie Jackson was not going to survive. And he did withdraw his nomination from consideration today so he can spend more time with his rum and coke. Diet Coke, I'm sorry. But Rachel Maddow and MSNBC, I looked at a couple of their other shows last night, they squandered so much time targeting Ronnie Jackson at the same time that they never mentioned these cave-in, cowardly Democrats who were going to provide the margin of victory for the confirmation of Mike Pompeo. And there are many other issues, including Macron's visit, whether or not he was able to persuade Trump to stay in the Iranian agreement. MSNBC is so focused on serving up political dirt on Republicans that they don't cover the news. And as you can see from what I cover here every day, there's plenty of news and there's stuff I never have room for here. Now, I'm sure tonight in primetime, MSDNC will be all over the Ronnie Jackson withdrawal. They'll take credit for it. They got his scalp. And then they will pile on with the juicy sound bites from today's hearing in Congress, where Scott Pruitt, the EPA director, was grilled by Democrats and softballed by Republicans. And there are 10 different investigations. There are all these different issues, the $43,000 secure phone booth, his sweetheart deal for the $50 a night condo on Capitol Hill, from a lobbyist who had business before the EPA. He has serious ethical problems, conflicts of interest. He gave raises to his cronies who had been part of the shell company that owned the mansion in Oklahoma City. I mean, it's quite a litany. And Scott Pruitt, was he channeling Tricky Dick? He said, "I have nothing to hide. I'm not afraid to admit it's been a learning process coming to Washington and working in the big leagues." But Frank Pallone of New Jersey lowered the boom. Pruitt has brought secrecy, conflicts of interest, and scandal to the EPA. In any other administration, Republican or Democrat, you would be long gone by now. Pallone and other Democrats insisted that he should have already resigned, but Pruitt basically just tried to deflect their questions, blame other people, claim that he didn't know about the raises that went to his two buddies from Oklahoma. New Jersey's Pallone was extremely blunt. He told the director, "Pruitt, you are unfit to hold public office, undeserving of the public trust. Every indication we have is you really should resign." And Anna Eshoo, who's a Silicon Valley Democrat and a woman I've known since she went to Congress in the early 90s, she's not a real tough inquisitor. But she said to Pruitt, "You have a solid record of violating ethics rules from the state level to the federal government. I think it's an embarrassment." Then she asked, "Do you have any remorse? Yes or no?" Pruitt didn't answer yes or no. He said, "I think there are changes I've made already. I've made a change from first class to coach travel." Then she returned to her call for a yes or no answer and asked Pruitt if he would reimburse the government. And when she didn't get a response that was yes or no, she cut him off and said, "Look, I may be elected, but I'm not a fool. This is not Dodge Question Day." Meanwhile, senators have advanced a bill to protect Robert Mueller, the special counsel, in case Trump tries to fire him. And what is notable here is that four Republicans on the Judiciary Committee, including the chairman, Charles Grassley, voted in favor of this bill, even though they know that their boss, Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader of the Senate, has said he will not allow it to come to the floor for a vote. Now, even Orrin Hatch, who is a lame duck has been for a long time, but now it's official. He doesn't support the legislation, but he said that firing Mueller would cause a firestorm and bring the administration's agenda to a halt. It could even result in impeachment. Do you think? Not with these Republicans, but he's willing to say that to try to brush Trump back. The bill is called the Special Counsel Independence and Integrity Act, would codify into law the existing Justice Department regulation that says a special counsel may be fired only by the Attorney General, only for good cause. It would create a 10-day window, and if a special counsel is fired, he gets to go to a judge and try to prove that it was an improper dismissal. Now, it doesn't appear that this is actually constitutional, but it is, I guess, a warning signal, a flare sent up for Trump's consideration. Every day I pause for a moment to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. Today I want to mention Janet Price, Margaret Anderson, Joey Perillo, and Wendy Gebauer. Every month they kick in $5 or $10 based on what they can afford. And I invite you to join them. In fact, if you want to pause the podcast for a minute, you can visit peterbcollins.com. Look for the menu tab. When you pull it down, click on Become a Subscriber. It takes you to the sign-up page, and in just a minute or two, you can pick a level of support that's comfortable for you. And if you're allergic to PayPal, you can address your correspondence and send in checks, money order, paper money, I'll take it, Box 150-660, San Rafael, California, 94915. My mailing address again, Box 150-660, San Rafael, California, 94915. Now, one subscriber, Joe Davis, sent me a link to an article that I hadn't seen. And there is a new report on the super-secret FISA court and its actions during the first year of the Trump administration. And the super-secret court, which I think should be completely dismantled, there is no place for this secret court in our system. Anyway, they published data that showed that last year they denied 26 applications for FISA warrants. These are for surveillance of American persons, U.S. persons. And the court, in its history, had only denied 21 orders since it was founded in 1978 and up through 2016. So the court is either seeing a lot of bogus applications, or it's actually been reading the Constitution and applying it as it should. Or maybe it's a little bit of both. Now, we also learned that a certain number of applications were modified by the court and then approved. Let's see, that was, there were 1,147 requests in full, and 391 of those were granted after they were modified. Now, of course, the reasons for this are a secret. So, this is a result of the Ed Snowden revelations that led to the mealy-mouthed legislation called the USA Patriot Act. What was it called? It was a stupid bill passed about 2 years ago, and it required the court to release at least statistical information, and also to, at times, appoint an advocate for the rest of us, an amicus briefer, or what's called an amicus curiae. And we know that in three cases, the court advised the Trump administration that it was going to appoint this kind of advocate, and the government either pulled or modified the application rather than face that process. Well, we saw the bromance between Emmanuel Macron and Donnie Trump on full display in Washington this week, the 21-gun salute, the state dinner, all that affection and hand-holding and dandruff picking. And Angela Merkel, who is arguably more important in European politics than the young Emmanuel Macron. I mean, she's been in power for a much longer time and has a country that's larger and wealthier. Well, she is coming in for a visit at the White House on Friday, and they're going to give her a working lunch. So is Trump going to order KFC or Big Macs to share with Angela Merkel? If you remember last year when she visited, she was trying to be diplomatic, and the photographer said, "Hey, you guys want to shake hands?" And she looked at Trump and in her best English said, "Do you want to shake hands?" And he just ignored her. I mean, it was really rude and cold. So it'll be interesting to see if Merkel can tag team with Macron and persuade Trump not to pull out of the Iranian nuclear deal with Iran, the United States, and five other countries in the middle of May when the next deadline comes up. My friend Norman Solomon has a great column posted today at consortiumnews.com entitled, Why the DNC is Fighting WikiLeaks and Not Wall Street. And he takes the DNC and its chair Tom Perez to task for the crazy lawsuit announced last Friday, suing the Russian government, the Trump campaign, and WikiLeaks, along with Julian Assange. And Solomon points out correctly that suing Russia is just silly, because you can win a civil judgment against them that is completely unenforceable. And getting Russian people to participate in this trial, getting testimony or depositions, it's just purely politics and political theater. And he correctly identifies it as such. He says, in truth, the Democrats' Russia fixation leaves significantly less messaging space for economic and social issues that the vast majority of Americans care about far more. He writes, even as some congressional Democrats who've been prominent Russiagate enthusiasts have recognized that this lawsuit is off track. When Wolf Blitzer asked a member of the House Intelligence Committee, Jackie Speier, whether she believes that Perez and his DNC team are making a big mistake by filing this lawsuit, Speier responded, well, I'm not supportive of it. Whether it's a mistake or not, we'll soon find out. She called the lawsuit ill-conceived. And joining other critics of this, you know, this lawsuit, Solomon writes that the most unprincipled part has to do with the targeting of Assange and WikiLeaks and the attack on press freedom. He says, in view of the National Democratic Party's deference to corporate power, we might see why the DNC is taking its current approach. It would be a much steeper uphill challenge to actually champion the interests of most Americans, which would require taking on Wall Street, a key patron of both political parties. And he closes with this. Willingness to challenge Wall Street would certainly alienate some of the Democratic Party's big donors, and such moves would likely curb the future earning power of high-ranking party officials who can now look forward to upward spikes in incomes from consultant deals and cushy positions at well-heeled firms. Very well said, Norman. Also, yesterday, I mentioned how the DCCC, that's the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, has been leaning on progressives to get out of races where there's more than one Democrat running for a congressional seat. The latest is in Colorado. And Levi Tilleman, who's an author, inventor, a former official with the Obama administration's Energy Department, he moved back to Colorado to run against a sitting Republican named Mike Kaufman. And he is basically a kind of Bernie Democrat. He's working on Medicare for All, free community college, confronting economic inequality. Then pops up Jason Crow, running as a Democrat, a corporate lawyer, Army veteran. He's got the backing of the Democratic establishment. Then Steny Hoyer, the number two Democrat in the House, part of the Pelosi leadership. He came to Denver, and he sat down with Tilleman. Now, Tilleman has recorded the conversation, and that may, you know, brush up against the law. It's also considered impolite for politicians to expose one another's perfidy. But I credit him with doing this. He leaked a recording of his meeting with Hoyer to The Intercept, and Lee Fung, a great reporter, wrote this up, and it really shows. Here's Hoyer. Staying out of primaries sounds small-d democratic, very intellectual, and very interesting. But if you stay out of primaries and somebody wins in the primary who can't possibly win in the general, well, Hoyer said, that's why we urge people like you to drop out. And you keep saying I'd like you to get out of the race, and of course that's correct, Hoyer said. So this is happening all across the country. And the DCCC and the Pelosi leadership team are elbowing progressives out of the race. Now, I know Nancy Pelosi, and I've explained before that I covered her as the congresswoman from San Francisco, and after I left local radio, I worked on a campaign for her in 1996. I like her personally. I respect her progressive politics, but they don't get reflected when she operates in the leadership. That's when she adopts her cold-blooded reptilian political instincts. And Pelosi doesn't like contested primaries. She likes to have one Democrat, hopefully a rich guy who can pay for his own or her own campaign. And she has actively done what Hoyer is doing here in the past. In a separate article at The Intercept, David Dayan and Ryan Grimm have a great report on the race that I mentioned yesterday in this same context. It's the Southern California 39th District, and the anointed candidate of the Democratic leadership is a former Republican named Gil Cisneros, and they are leaning on him because he's a veteran, but he won the lottery, and he's able to shovel millions of dollars into his own campaign. Since he won the lottery, he's given a lot to Democratic politicians, and that's what bought him a place in this race. And when The Intercept confronted the DCCC about a specific issue where a website was created that attacked one of the other Democrats in the race, Andy Thorburn, and called him a tax evader, well, it appeared very similar to materials that have been produced by the DCCC in the past. So they asked the DCCC, hey, is this cookie cutter stuff where you just substitute the name of one candidate for the next? And the spokeswoman, Meredith Kelly, said, without answering the question, this is the most baseless and embarrassing request that I've received from The Intercept yet. And please quote me on that. So the Democratic leadership, as we have pointed out, in our interview with Patrick Martin of the World Socialist website, they are actively recruiting conservative Democrats with experience in the military, with experience in the intelligence community, and they are reshaping the Democratic Party in significant ways that fly in the face of the wishes and the interests of the grassroots. Nancy Pelosi defends this, first of all, by tweaking Tillman for releasing the tape. But she said, in terms of candidates and campaigns, I don't see anything inappropriate in what Mr. Hoyer was engaged in, a conversation about the realities of life in the race as to who can make the general election. And finally today, I've been reporting about Glenn Greenwald's great exposure of MSNBC's black anchor, Joy Reid. And Joy Reid used to run a blog that included a lot of anti-gay comments, homophobic remarks. And BuzzFeed reports, without any credit to Glenn Greenwald for exposing this controversy, that Joy Reid was planning to participate today in an event in New York organized by the former U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara, which included the openly gay mayor of South Bend, Indiana, Pete Buttigieg. I hope I pronounced his name right. Anyway, she has withdrawn as she continues to blame the Internet Archive's Wayback Machine. It got hacked, and somebody added hateful comments to my original hateful comments. Well, why don't you call CrowdStrike, Joy, and see if they can straighten all this out for you. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. Please share it far and wide. We post it on YouTube, and when you visit there, click subscribe. Maybe they'll send me a check someday.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.